It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the Wisconsin premiere of a new work from composer John Harbison, featuring the work of Wisconsin poet Laureen Niedeker.
First, a cyclist in Germantown was struck and killed by a motor vehicle last weekend, bringing the total of bicycle fatalities this year to 9, more than double the number of deaths in all of 2014.
Unfortunately, this kind of accident is not uncommon. According to research from our next guest, more than a third of recent bicycle fatalities were caused by a motor vehicle striking the bicycle from behind. He's also looked into who tends to be at fault during car and bike accidents and what still needs to be done to make the roads safer for everyone.
Robert Schneider joins us now. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So we should start off by saying we're talking about bicycle fatalities in Wisconsin, not huge numbers. The state averages about 10 bike fatalities a year, according to the Department of Transportation. So they represent, all tragic, of course, but they represent a small number of total traffic fatalities. What do we learn by taking a closer look at these crashes, though?
Yeah, we took a look at the 2011 to 2013 crashes that occurred in particular, and more than 3,300 of them overall, and then took an in-depth look at 229 of them, 33 of which were fatalities. One of the striking patterns was that the more severe crashes, including a lot of the fatalities, occurred on higher speed roadways. Often the fatalities involved motorists striking bicyclists from behind, which is actually a fairly rare situation for most bicyclist crashes. But when it does occur and a motorist is traveling at a fairly high rate of speed, that's when you have a very high risk for severe or fatal injury. One of the common types of locations that this occurs is in more rural areas rather than urban areas, where there's higher speed roadways and bicyclists may not have that much shoulder space to work with.
Now, with that in mind, do we have an idea of why bike fatalities are up this year? I know we're talking about small numbers. There can be that kind of variation, and why we're seeing crashes this year. Do we know why that would be?
I don't know if we can point to anything specific for this year. The average, as you said, is about 10 or 11 per year. We looked back to 2004 and 2005 when we were looking at our data, and in those years there were 14 bicyclist fatalities both years. So it seems the numbers go up and down around 10 or 11 each year. There's some variation. But since there's a relatively small number to work with, we can't really say that there's a big statistical difference. Though still, any more than zero bicycle fatalities is too many.
And when it comes to overall numbers of crashes, fatal or otherwise, do we see a trend over time there?
So overall, we saw a decrease in crashes through the late 2008 through 2012 or so. And many states are actually seeing an uptick in pedestrian and bicycle crashes, in particular fatalities. They've seen that for the last couple of years. So Wisconsin is mirroring a national trend. One reason why that may occur is that there could potentially be more people out walking and biking, taking advantage of those efficient modes of transportation, getting exercise, and just having more people out on the roadways may contribute to a higher number of fatalities. However, we also looked at data related to the overall number of pedestrian and bicycle commuters to work. And once we accounted for that, at least between 2004 and 2013, we were seeing that the rate of pedestrian and bicycle fatalities and overall crashes had decreased over that period. So in general, there was positive news, but the uptick in the last year or two is concerning.
Talking to Robert Schneider, urban planning professor at UW-Milwaukee, about bicycle crashes, car, bike crashes in particular here in Wisconsin, some of the factors leading into them, and we'll get into some possible solutions, too. Let's get back into your research into the cause of those car, bike crashes. You tried, in many cases, to assess who was at fault, not in a legal sense, but just trying to figure out who caused the crash. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so we read the in-depth police write-up that comes with each crash report. and from that assessed who was making the primary error that led to the crash. In some cases, this may be somebody who disobeyed a traffic signal or a stop sign. In other cases, it may have been a motorist rear-ending a bicyclist, for example. It may have been somebody traveling while intoxicated. All those reasons were what went into how we determined who was primarily responsible for a crash. Of the fatalities that I mentioned before, the 33 that we looked at, 58% of those were primarily the motorist's responsibility, and 24% were primarily the bicyclist's. We did assess 3% of them to be both motorist and bicyclist, and then 15% for both, and then 3% we didn't know if there was any particular cause behind them.
So looking at driver error, whichever vehicle is being operated here, it sounds like maybe mentality changes could improve things. What kind of things could drivers be thinking that might help the state drive down the number of crashes like that?
Yeah, I think this is a really important concept to be thinking about. And the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety has a Share and Be Aware program that really is trying to educate people and help drivers think to have an expectation to see pedestrians and bicyclists on the roadway. Also, make sure that pedestrians and bicyclists know about how to safely travel on roadways. But in particular for drivers, since they're driving a heavy vehicle, and often that can deal a very severe or fatal blow to pedestrians or bicyclists, that it's really important to be expecting to see your neighbors who may be walking and biking out on the roadways, and be very careful around them. That includes driving the speed limit, so slower speeds are very important for reducing the risk of injuries and crashes. Also, reducing being distracted, so do not text and drive. Don't talk on a cell phone. It may be legal, but it definitely is a distracting thing to do. And definitely do not drink and drive. Intoxicated drivers or bicyclists were involved in 27% of the bicycle fatalities that we looked at. We didn't know from the data if it was the bicyclist or the driver, but alcohol use was a common factor as well.
And in the cases where the bicycle operator was at fault, apart from alcohol, what kind of trends, what kind of things can we learn in those cases?
So a number of them were bicyclists who disobeyed a red traffic signal, and as they were crossing through the intersection, were struck by a vehicle coming in the opposite direction that had a green. And so that was one common type. Another case was when a bicyclist had a stop sign and ran through that and was hit by a motorist in the opposite direction as well. So definitely being aware and following the rules of the road. You know, bicyclists are legal users of the roadway and can travel in travel lanes similarly to cars. That also means that it's really important to follow the same traffic rules, and they're designed that way to keep everybody safe.
Now let's talk about infrastructure a little bit. You mentioned those country roads, maybe not a lot of shoulder for a bicyclist to take advantage of when a car is passing. What kind of infrastructure changes based on your review of all these crashes might help?
Yeah, so for sure in rural areas, paved shoulders are very important type of facility for bicyclists, just providing a little bit of extra space to be further away from the cars that may be traveling in the main roadway lane. It's also important to remember, as an aside, for drivers who are on these rural roadways, even if there is a shoulder, sometimes there may be gravel in that shoulder or there may be potholes, so bicyclists may sometimes move into the travel lane and do that very legally, but then be in front of the motorists who are approaching. So they aren't always perfect, and it's important to maintain those shoulders very well as a part of roadway design. In more urban areas, adding bike lanes, as cities across the state have done, Madison's a leader for doing that, that can complement other efforts to slow traffic on some of the major arterial roadways within cities. As we slow traffic on those major thoroughfares, people are more likely to be aware of pedestrians and bicyclists, more likely to yield to pedestrians when they're crossing the roadway, and less likely to create a more severe injury crash.
And briefly, Robert, as we wrap up, I know apart from the numbers, you've also tried to put a human face on the people who are survivors or victims of these incidents.
Yeah, and this is something, you know, as a traffic safety researcher, we look at a lot of numbers, you know, thousands of crashes and look at the reports. But these are really our neighbors. They're fathers, their daughters, their aunts, their grandparents. These are people who have been involved in crashes. And in looking at these data, we want to prevent these crashes from occurring to other people who are out on the roadway and really make it safe for everybody who's out there.
And do you see, again, briefly, an improvement? Are we paying more attention?
That's a good question. I think that with our efforts in programs like Share and Be Aware and you know, spreading the word about pedestrians and bicyclists being on the roadway, that we are. One really important thing that happens as communities invest in better infrastructure for walking and biking, there tend to be more people who participate in walking and biking, either going to the store or to work or just out for a ride and getting exercise. That itself can increase the safety of other people because then motorists are more aware of pedestrians and bicyclists on the roadway.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Robert Schneider, assistant professor in the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about bicycle crashes and fatalities in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get the latest on research about protecting kids from head injuries while playing football.
First, the poetry of Fort Atkinson native Lorene Niedeker is being increasingly read and celebrated, and now it's also the basis of a new work by composer John Harbison. Harbison has a Pulitzer Prize to his name, along with what's known as the MacArthur Genius Grant. His opera, The Great Gatsby, was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera for their 25th anniversary.
Harbison's settings of seven Niedeker poems commissioned by the Tanglewood Music Festival will be performed today during the annual Token Creek Chamber Music Festival, which takes place each summer near Madison. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what first drew you to the poetry of Lorene Niedeker?
I liked the conciseness and the sense of things being left out and the sense of a certain musicality of phrase. Also seemed an opportunity to find some poems that I could put next to each other that had a certain narrative quality.
Did the poems that you selected, now there are seven of them, did they have any sort of natural grouping, or did you just draw from her entire collected work?
I drew from a large number of short poems. I knew I wanted for this particular project shorter poems, which I could rearrange into a kind of sequence. Very often in her poems, you sense that something is going on that you don't hear about in the poem, but you can piece it together. And I simply took that idea and pushed it, I think, a little further.
Right, and in reading some of these poems, they're very spare. There's a lot of white space just looking visually at the poem on the paper, and there are not many words. She's a very Spartan poet. And she herself, she lived alone in the woods and in a cabin in Fort Atkinson. Does that kind of solitude translate to the music?
Well, you hope it does. It isn't. To me, the interesting thing about these particular texts was the way that she doesn't tell her whole story or doesn't really want to fill in all of the blanks. I agree about the blanks. You see them when you read the poems and you hear them, I think, if you read the poems a certain way. And the sound that accompanies the voice in this piece is, I guess, something about that space.
Well, let's take a listen.
Soft air.
always north of him. A couple of lines that I picked up there in the poem. What were you trying to do with this one?
Well, I set the title, which is Florida, which is obviously a decision of my own. I think she probably would have thought that that's not an integral part of the poem. To me, I don't understand the poem without it, because everything that is then said is something about her climate, which is obviously the Wisconsin climate, which is not Florida, which is part of the dissonance that is going on between this couple. So right away, all the details of that poem are really her musing on the climatic difference between two people.
Now, a lot of times when composers or translators work closely with a piece of text, with a poet, they sort of feel close to the person who wrote that text that they're working with. Did that happen to you? Did you end up feeling close to Laureen Niedecker?
Well, it always does happen, yeah. And even with poets that I don't particularly like their temperament, I did a lot of poems of Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet who lived in Berkeley, and I didn't particularly like him as a friend. I never met him. But I felt very connected and collaborative with him, though, of course, he has no role actively in that. Similarly with Niedecker. She becomes a presence, and you want her, I think, when a song is sung with a text by a poet, you want the poet temperamentally to be present.
And she is from Wisconsin. A lot of times we think about her poetry as being steeped in Wisconsin. Do you have that kind of connection with the state? You don't live here full time, but what is your connection to Wisconsin?
It's different from hers, of course, because hers is much more continuous, unusually continuous. I came here first in 64, which is a long time ago, after a summer in Mississippi with the freedom movement in the South, and have been coming ever since, and I'm always kind of readopting it and getting used to it again. My origins are probably very Eastern, but certainly that character of her writing and this very specific landscape is something that appeals to me because I've seen it, and I kind of know what the emotional sort of climate is around it.
We're talking to composer John Harbison right now, talking about his new composition called Seven Poems of Laureen Niedecker. Do you think that you can hear Wisconsin in her poetry and also by association now that you've worked with them in your music?
I certainly hear someone committed to a place, not always in the most joyful fashion, that she sort of toughs it out a lot of the time. She accepts the hardness of a surrounding. I'm always interested to hear her compared to Emily Dickinson. They're both poets very little recognized in their lifetime. Their economic situation is so different. Laureen Niedecker is really a working class person. She never ascends to such a social high milieu as Dickinson does. And I hear that in the poetry too. I think that what strikes me in her words is the laconic quality, and that's more Midwestern than Eastern, the sense of someone who's not going to tell you everything easily.
Did that make her harder for you to unlock as you were composing for her words?
Well, it's something I wanted because I guess the choice of a text is always the effort to try to write something different. So that particular quality of hers was welcome, though, yes, as you suggested, it created some unusual territory, a very short piece that took me longer than I expected to figure out.
And you worked for a long time. You've had a collaboration with the Token Creek Chamber Music Festival. What do you think makes this specific piece of work a good fit for that venue?
Well, we've been emphasizing landscape and very particular landscape of our festival, and we do it in a barn and we do it on a farm. And there is a very, I'd say, solicitous presence of nature. We're not as indoors as we might be at most concerts. So yes, I think that was certainly part of the appropriateness of bringing the piece back.
Are you going to miss her now that you're not living right alongside her, in her words, in her brain, in a sense, now that the work is done?
That's actually very apt because, yes, I always miss the poet for a while, and sometimes that causes me to go back and make more music from the poet's words. I've sometimes needed quite a while to wear out a connection to a poet. And one present connection with the now New England poet, Louise Glick, has been going on for now four pieces. So it sometimes takes quite a while to get to a point where I feel that the friendship has yielded what it can.
John, thank you so much for coming in and talking today.
You're very welcome.
That was John Harbison, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and MIT professor. He joined us to talk about his new work called Seven Poems of Laureen Niedecker. It's premiering this afternoon at the Token Creek Music Festival. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Kids are heading back to school. It doesn't just mean they're hitting the books. A lot of youngsters are also involved in fall sports.
Concussions are a big concern in any kind of contact sport, and a couple of new research studies provide important information specifically for parents whose children play tackle football.
We're going to hear first about a study that compared different helmets and the protection they provide. Tim McGuine is a senior scientist in the Division of Sports Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, football players have a lot of protective gear. The helmet, obviously the relevant one for preventing concussions. What specifically does a helmet do to protect specifically from the risk of concussion?
Well, originally helmets were designed to simply prevent skull fractures and skull lacerations. And it's only been in recent years when they've taken on a role to try to add supposed protective effects for concussion, the idea of making a bigger offset, making it more padding on the outside of the shell, doing some of the other things, and putting different types of padding in to try to maybe attenuate the forces that would be transmitted to the skull and the brain.
And out there on the market today, is there a wide range of material and design that's being sold?
The three major helmet companies are very, very similar in terms of they all have a polycarbonate-type shell. Some integrate some sort of Kevlar type material with a titanium or steel face mask, some aluminum face mask. So the designs are not that dramatically different. They all, are designed pretty much the same. They look similar, so there are. But there are variations in terms of different brands and models have some specific changes between them.
And as I understand it, there are $100 models. There are also up to $500 models being billed as better, stronger, more protective. And that's where some UW research you worked on comes in. You looked at whether those more expensive ones were more effective. What kind of things did you find out?
Well, we looked at a lot of factors because concussions, if they were just related to the impact forces on the brain or to the helmet, it'd be easy to say, yes, that would be effect or a way to prevent them. But concussions are multifactorial, meaning that there's height and weight of the player, previous concussion history, the type of position they're playing, those type of things. So we looked at all the factors that we could in terms of the age of the helmet, the brand, the model, how many years the kid had played football. We even looked at whether they played youth tackle football. Would that make them more at risk? And we basically found that the helmets that were on the market that are most readily available, the ones that most schools purchase for $100 to $200, performed as well as the helmets marketed exclusively to parents to prevent concussions from some of the manufacturers. So some of the manufacturers produced a very expensive helmet, and a lot of the schools said, we can't afford this, so they marketed directly to parents. And our data showed that there really wasn't a difference, that a 3- or 4-year-old helmet, if it was well-maintained, provided by the school, offered the same level of protection as the more expensive helmets. And we need to say that the helmets really do a very, very effective job overall in reducing the incidence of concussions.
Now, when I think about a helmet being sold, I guess I imagine it's tested in a way like a crash test dummy in a car would be. Am I right? Or what goes into testing?
Yes, and exactly, that's it. So a lot of the manufacturers, to meet certain safety standards, they will drop it on a force platform and have computer sensors measure the impact that it would attenuate by doing so by 5 or 10 drops and then making these assumptions. Our proposal or our methods are much different. We do population-based studies. So in, over the last 5 years, we've enrolled 10 years, enrolled 16,000 kids in different prevention studies in the state of Wisconsin. And that's a far more effective way to do it. So instead of dropping the helmet 10 times, we had 130,000 times where the helmet was were worn and played in. So the kids put these on 130,000 times, and then we look at the rate of exposure and then and the type of concussions that occurred.
So that's much more of a real-world, in-practice kind of analysis than a drop test.
Exactly. I'm very leery about concussion studies that look at 30 subjects in the lab or drop the helmet 10 times. We need to do population-based studies. And when you control for all these factors like we did, you know, even playing youth football, some people say you need to play that because you will learn how to tackle more effectively and prevent your concussions. Other people say, no, we shouldn't do it because concussions are cumulative. And by having more risk and as a youth, we're more likely to have concussions as a senior in high school. We didn't find either factor making a role. So kids playing youth football had no greater risk of concussion in high school than those that never played at all.
Talking to Tim McGuine from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health about concussions and protective gear in youth football. And we'll be talking more about long-term concussions and football in just a little bit. Tim, one thing I wonder, if I'm wearing a $500 helmet that I think is better, safer, it really isn't, though, might I play differently? Is there a concern that I think I'm at less risk so I don't play as safely?
That's a controversial topic. Some people think so. There was a soccer headgear studies where they had female athletes wear soccer headgear, and they looked at it, and they were said to be more aggressive once they wore protective headgear. I know that's out there, and some people, you know, say that. I would say that to some extent I believe that. The more we pad these kids up, the more invulnerable they may feel, and that our latest research shows, you know, simply just changing the way they practice can significantly reduce the rate of concussion, and those are far more effective than I think we're just going to put bigger, stronger equipment on these kids. And it doesn't just, not just a helmet, but an ankle brace or a knee brace or shoulder pads, anything like that. It only has so much of a protective effect, and we don't want to make kids thinking, I can be invulnerable, I can still do unsafe techniques out there and be protected from an injury.
Now, as I understand it, one factor in concussion isn't just direct head impact, but if you're talking about offensive, defensive line people colliding together, it's the quick start and stop, even if there's not a direct head impact. Is that right? And if so, is the helmet irrelevant in that particular cause?
Right, the acceleration, deceleration. So again, I like to tell people, if you think of your brain as similar to an egg yolk, and we can pad that side, that egg significantly, but if we shake that egg quite a bit, that egg yolk would slosh around inside that shell. And then that, what you're saying is specifically the case, that the brain is essentially folding in fluid, and we stop and start suddenly, that brain would have a tendency to slosh around, and regardless of what type of impact took place on the helmet, that starting stopping could play a role.
Well, let's get back to the helmet. Does something like age of the helmet matter, using a used one, a five-year-old one, versus a brand spanking new one?
Well, you know, we thought that would be the case, too, and helmets were originally designed to last for 10 years with occasional reconditioning, meaning they would be sent back to the factory on a bi-yearly basis or sometimes every year to go ahead and look for micro cracks and clean them up and look for any defective padding. And we found that didn't seem to make a case either, that a helmet that was 2 or 3 years old that was well maintained and well fitted to the athlete, there was no difference in the rate of concussion there. So a parent should not be thinking, hey, I need to buy a new helmet for my son every year, because in our study, again, with 192,000 times the kids went out and played football, there was just no difference.
And before we let you go, any thoughts on a fit, making sure a kid is wearing the right helmet when they're playing?
Well, I like to say that, you know, in the helmet designs have some individual characteristics that make them easier to fit certain types of heads. We do like to tell kids, basically, a helmet needs to be checked each week, and the player themselves are responsible to make sure it's properly fit, and that if they adjust pads or do things on their own, that could make it more at risk. So we try to really educate the kids and the coaches to do this. And by and large, the coaches in the state of Wisconsin do a fantastic job of making sure the kids are playing and tackling safely. They're far, far ahead of, I guess, most areas of the country in doing so.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Tim McGuine. He's a senior scientist in sports medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health.
Coming up, we'll continue the conversation about avoiding concussions and other brain injuries in youth football players. And we want to hear from you. Does your child play youth football? At what age did they start to play? And how concerned are you about possible concussions? You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or post a question on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We just heard about recent research about whether more expensive helmets protect youth football players more effectively.
Now we're going to turn our attention to a study that shows that the age at which a child starts playing tackle football can have an impact on long-term brain health.
And we want to hear from you. Does your child play youth football? At what age did they start to play? And how worried are you about possible concussions? Do you feel that the league shows enough concern for their players' well-being? You can join the conversation by calling 800-64 That's 800-642-1234, or post a question or comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Dr. Robert Stern, professor of neurology, neurosurgery, and anatomy and neurobiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. He's also director of the clinical core of the Alzheimer's Disease and CTE Center. Dr. Stern, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob. Great to be on.
And Dr. Julie Stamm is also with us, currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She conducted a study on the impact of the starting age of youth football players on brain injuries. Dr. Stamm, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you were the lead authors on this recent study looking at the starting age for tackle football, how it impacts brain health later in life. Dr. Stamm, why did you focus in on that variable?
So we were very interested in whether or not the age you started playing, given that children's brains are going through quite a bit of development, and we were interested in whether or not the age you started hitting your head would lead to later life problems. And we really focused in on that age 12 because there's a lot of brain development occurring and very rapid development occurring in the ages around age 9 or 10 through age 12.
And Dr. Stern, who are you looking at? You're looking at, obviously, people who are older and have played the game for a long time and then looking back at when they started.
Yeah, and that's a very important issue is in terms of the generalizability of our findings. This was a study of former NFL players, mm-hmm. not just your run-of-the-mill people who played a little bit of youth football or even high school or college, but these are a bunch of former NFL players, all currently in middle age between the ages of 40 and 65. And they're participants in another study of mine, a larger study of ours at Boston University called the DETECT study. And we're trying to figure out a whole lot of things about the long-term complications of repetitive hits to the head earlier in life. So that's the group that we looked at, former NFL players who are currently in middle age who are part of this study. And we divided a group of 40 of these former players into two groups. One group that started playing tackle football before the age of 12, and the other group that started at age 12 or older. And each one of those pairs were currently the same age. So we were really trying to make sure we're not looking at current age, we're not looking at the era in which people played. We're trying to really figure out if the age of the time someone started hitting their head and tackle football can lead to later life problems. But in this very select group of people who are former professional football players.
So, Dr. Stamm, let's hear the results. Comparing these two groups, these football players, some started before 12, some started after with tackle football. Was there a significant difference?
There was, and we specifically looked at a specific, what's called the white matter tract in the brain called the corpus callosum, and this is a pathway. Your white matter is like the connections and the superhighway connecting different parts of the brain. And this particular pathway connected the two sides of the brain, the two hemispheres of the brain. And we saw that the integrity of this pathway was altered or reduced in those who started playing at age 12, or I'm sorry, before age 12, compared to those who started playing later.
And does that, Dr. Stamm, have a symptomatic result? If there's that difference, would we observe different behavior, different risks of cognitive decline?
So it's possible. We didn't look at that specifically in this study. However, in an earlier study that we did actually see differences in thinking and memory and verbal intelligence as well. So we can't say that specifically from this study, but we have seen that in our previous research.
Well, Dr. Stern, let's go back to the beginning here and talk about that brain circa age 12. What is happening in the brain that might make that a really relevant time of year for the future long-term impact of head injuries?
Sure. Well, at that time of life, the brain is going through this incredible and rapid development and maturation. So a variety of parts of the brain are growing, developing greater connections, getting larger. The white matter tracts of the brain are getting myelinated, meaning that they're getting this kind of fatty substance around it to make them communicate faster with other parts of the brain. And so during that key period, all this fast development is occurring. And so what might happen is that that period of development might create this potential window of vulnerability, a neurodevelopmental window of vulnerability, that if you hurt the brain during that time period, there may be greater consequences than if you start hurting it at another time in life.
Talking to Dr. Robert Stern and Dr. Julie Stamm about their research on early tackle football playing, starting around age 12 and earlier, and its possible long-term impacts on people who go on to play football for a long time. We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Greg is on the line in Augusta. Greg, hi.
Hi. I'm a 68-year-old college football player. I'll try to make this brief, but I started playing full contact in the eighth grade. I was a starter in high school as a sophomore, a starter in college as a freshman. I had my bell rung. We used to say, "We got your bell rung." I got my bell rung, maybe four or five times. In college, a couple times real bad, where I was down and out for the count. So, but I went back in the game both times. So here I am. I'm 68 years old. I wish I could be evaluated, but I think I'm none the worse for it.
Greg, thanks a lot for the call. So, Dr. Stern, is there any way to know, looking back at age 68, if having your bell rung, which we now take more seriously these days as a concussion, could be impacting him? I know you can't diagnose him over the phone, obviously, but how do we know something like that?
Sure. Well, you know, the caller actually raised two very, very important issues. One is that not everyone who started playing football at an early age or had a huge, lengthy, successful career in football is going to have later life problems. I think there's been this huge amount of media hype and other hype suggesting that overall football ain't good for you, and that's really not the message. We don't know who specifically is going to have long-term problems, and it's not going to be everyone. In this study of former professional football players, the ones who started playing earlier had a greater likelihood of having difficulties in certain parts of the brain. The other important thing the caller raised is that we're not specifically looking at concussions. Concussions being those hits to the body or the head, resulting in the brain being jostled around and then having subsequent symptoms of having that bell rung, seeing stars, feeling nauseated, having headache, feeling in a fog, all these kinds of things. What we're really concerned about in this study and in other areas of our research is what we refer to as the subconcussive trauma, the repetitive head impacts that don't necessarily result in symptoms of concussion. And in a typical youth player, there's data out there where they put these special accelerometer gizmos in the helmets of the players. They can have hundreds of hits above a certain threshold of G-force, above 15 G. Hundreds of hits above that threshold per season. A typical college player may have in the high hundreds on average, or 1,000 hits above that threshold per season. So we're talking about the hit after hit after hit that doesn't necessarily result in any symptoms, no diagnosis of concussion, etc. It's part of what is kind of inherent in the game of football. And it's those repetitive hits that seem to have a potential impact in some people later in life.
Dr. Stamm, this is one study among others. It's not a huge study, but based on what you're looking at there, do you have thoughts, maybe even recommendations for how we should approach tackle football for kids 12 and under?
That's a great question. And right now, based on the research, it's too early to really make any recommendations. It's very important that we make recommendations based on the best evidence. And while this is a very beginning, and we really need more research in order to really understand how these repeated hits to the head can affect children then later in life. It does, however, kind of make sense that hitting your head repeatedly as a child and when your brain is developing may not be a good idea. So it's definitely something, we do need more research, but it's something to definitely consider when considering, having your child play football. But I also want to say that sports are incredibly important for kids. And the goal of this research is to make sports and make football safer for kids, because there's so many great benefits of sports that we don't want to discourage people from playing sports. We just want to figure out how we can play the game more safely.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Stamm, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stern, thanks to you as well.
Thanks very much, Rob.
We've been talking to Drs. Julia Stamm and Robert Stern. They're the lead authors on a recent study that looked at youth football and its impact on brain health. It was published in the Journal of Neurotrauma.